Though he built the ark out of gopher wood, the flood it came and the ark it stood. And those arks are moving, 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 and those arks are moving, moving along. Who built the ark? Now who built the ark? Oh, no, my lord. No darks are moving, moving, moving. No darks are moving, moving along.
I'm Bob Crawford, and welcome to RTN Theology 10. Today I'm joined by RTN Theology's new co-host and co-producer, a good friend of mine, pastor of Oak Church in Durham, North Carolina, Chris Breslin. Chris, welcome aboard.
It's good to be aboard.
Well, Chris, it was only a matter of time before you became an official part of this program, because you have been an unofficial part of several past RTN Theologies, most notably perhaps the Kate Bowler episode we did last year.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to get to do that. Kate was a professor of mine and a friend of mine after seminary, and her book's amazing, so it was a great chance to get to talk to it and get it out to more people.
So for those of you who don't know Chris, he and I have been friends for a few years now, and I kind of think of Chris in a lot of ways as a mentor, but he's somebody who always introduces me to the best music, the best books, the best films. And so he's always telling me about these things, sending me things that I should check out. And it made me realize, well, why not have Chris just be a part of RTN Theology, and then he can directly share the things he comes across with all of us.
Well, this is a little bit of pressure actually being on mic for this stuff. We'll give it a shot, see how it works.
We will. And so for our first episode together, officially, we are focusing on the life and work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Chris, for those in our audience who don't know who Dietrich Bonhoeffer was, what should we know about him?
Yeah, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German theologian in the 30s and early 40s, whose work has really kind of come into greater popularity just probably in the last couple decades. And Professor Haynes' book gets into some of the wide variety of embrace and interpretation of Bonhoeffer's work. But I know as a pastor that a lot of my folks have been in contact with Bonhoeffer's work. Some most notable are like Discipleship or Life Together, things that people have read in small groups or read themselves devotionally and have been important to their faith. So it was fun to get to hear from a historian in this current historic moment about this battle for Bonhoeffer.
Right. You mentioned Professor Haynes. That's Stephen Haynes, and he is the Albert Bruce Curry Professor of Religious Studies at Rhodes College in Memphis. And his most recent book is The Battle for Bonhoeffer. It looks at how liberals and conservatives over the decades since Bonhoeffer's death in World War II have claimed him. Everybody believes in some way that Bonhoeffer speaks for them. Chris, in addition to my interview with Stephen Haynes, you spoke with some other people about Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important and intriguing parts about Dietrich Bonhoeffer is not just that he was a brilliant theologian. I mean, the guy had two PhDs when he was in his, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and he's just crazy, off the charts brilliant. But it's how concrete his ministry was. How tied up it was in church life and politics and the arts and kind of all the things that matter mostly to our lives, not just as we have our nose like deeply in dense books. And so I really wanted to kind of bring some of that world out and some of the legacy of Bonhoeffer's work in real lives and local congregations. So we got to talk to Pastor Jose Humphreys, who is ministering in Harlem, and I think you'll hear from some of the interview, how important Harlem was to Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life, some of the questions I really wanted to put to Pastor Jose was what it was like to do ministry in Harlem today, and in what ways has Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life and message been important and resonant with the lives that he's in contact with now in 2019. Bob mentioned how much I love music, and so I couldn't be a part of an episode on Dietrich Bonhoeffer without thinking of this really great song written and inspired by one of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's prayers. And I got the chance to talk to Isaac Wardell, who's a producer of Bifrost Arts Music, and going forward, he's making music under the name of Porter's Gate Project with a variety of collaborators. And years back, they made a song motivated and inspired by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I love getting to talk about some of the intersection of theology and arts around the ways that Bonhoeffer's work gets practiced and even sang around the world.
Oh, Chris, I can't wait to hear all this. And again, thank you so much for being a part of RTN Theology. And everybody out there, we have some great episodes planned for the future. So stay tuned. Stephen Haynes, welcome to RTN Theology.
Thank you.
So this is your fourth book you've written about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Could you begin by giving us a brief overview of Bonhoeffer and his life for our listeners who might not be familiar with him?
Yeah, so Bonhoeffer was born in 1906. He was among others of his generation who sort of came of age between the world wars and was caught up in the Nazi phenomenon in his 20s. But he was a remarkable guy in many ways. He was very intelligent, very precocious intellectually. He was from a family of people who were very successful in the various areas of endeavor that they had chosen. And he was the youngest of three brothers. And so he was, Andy was the son of a well-known psychiatrist. So he was prepared to succeed. And he ended up deciding he wanted to study theology about the age of 13, which is a very unusual choice for people in his family. But I think he wanted to find an area that had not been sort of dominated by another male in his family. So he went that path and decided he wanted to be a theologian, but also a pastor. And so kept that dual vocation open to himself. And one of the interesting things about Bonhoeffer is how much travel he did overseas, particularly at a time after World War One, when Germans tended to be pretty insular and tended to not want to travel abroad. And so he ended up spending a year in Barcelona, Spain. He ended up spending a year in New York, which was very, I think, definitive for his future development. And he also developed between the wars and in the early 30s, a lot of ecumenical contacts, Christians in other European countries and in the United States, that sort of gave him a perspective that a lot of people in Germany didn't have at the time. So when Hitler came to power in 1933, he was 27. And he had just begun his academic career at the University of Berlin, and he'd also begun his career as a pastor. And despite his youth, it was very clear to him what Hitler and the Nazis meant for Germany, and he decided to become to resist in various fairly safe ways at first, but ultimately in more dangerous and dramatic ways. And by about 1939, he decided to join the German resistance that he was connected to through members of his family. and he played a dangerous sort of double game as a spy on behalf of the resistance, and ended up being arrested in 1943. The Gestapo didn't really know the extent of his resistance activities, but while he was in jail, those were discovered. And so he was not allowed to survive the war. He was hanged in Flossenbürg concentration camp just a couple of weeks before the end of the war as Hitler's personal prisoner.
And I think something that's so interesting about Bonhoeffer is that he was, you talk about his travels, he was invited at one point by Gandhi to come spend time with him.
Yeah, and I think he would have if this other opportunity that meant a lot to him hadn't come up, and it was to lead a seminary on the northern coast of Germany, basically an illegal seminary, a seminary that was run by the Confessing Church and was a place where Confessing Church ordinands could be trained in ways that were not possible in the universities, which had been taken over by Nazi sympathizing Christians.
So I think it'd be good to describe what was the situation of the church in Germany as Hitler rose to power.
It's a really interesting question and a complicated one. The simple answer is that a lot of Christians were very enthusiastic about Hitler's rise. They saw it as the answer to a lot of questions and problems that had sort of been brewing since the end of World War One. They saw him as a strong leader with a vision for German renewal. They also saw, they believed that the church would benefit from Hitler's rise because the church had sort of lost some of its cultural relevance during the Weimar period after World War One. And they wanted to get back to some traditional values that they believed Hitler represented, and Hitler portrayed himself as a churchman and as a good Christian. So there was a lot of, at least at the beginning, there was a lot of Christian enthusiasm. There was also some sort of people who wanted to wait and see and were less enthusiastic and even wanted to resist what they viewed as Nazi encroachment on the church. Now, these are people in the so-called Confessing Church, and they weren't, as has often been portrayed, they weren't people who were resisting Hitler or nationalism or German geopolitical aims, but they were worried that there were some Christians who wanted to sort of sell out the church entirely to Nazism. So there were people who were reluctant and cautious from the beginning. But to talk about Christian resistance to Nazism is complicated, because by the time that it became necessary to resist, there were very few options available.
It's really frightening, everything you just said, when we think about, and you know, the goal here isn't to draw, but you know what, your book, The Battle for Bonhoeffer, it's basically a historiography of the way that historians and theologians have in America have interpreted Bonhoeffer since his passing, and how certain Christian groups and even agnostic and atheist groups have claimed him, you know, in a way to support their theological, cultural, and political principles.
Right.
But I can't help listen to you talk about the church then in Germany and think about the church now here in the United States. And I don't like to bring presentism to the subject, but it's really hard not to draw parallels.
Yeah, I teach this material, and I find it hard as well, because I find, as I'm talking about the church in Germany and the compromises that were made and the enthusiasm that people had for Hitler, of course, it's easy for us to see Hitler for who he was. We look at history through the prism of the Holocaust and World War II. They didn't have that advantage. But I am struck by the sort of enthusiasm and sort of giddy anticipation that a lot of Christians have had in America in these last few years with the rise of Trump. And I worry that history sort of repeats itself, in the sense that people are willing to give up a lot. People are willing to ignore a lot of their own previous convictions to get some cultural goods that they think someone can provide.
You know, I pulled a quote from your book that I was going to wait until later in the interview to bring up, but I think it's appropriate probably to bring it up now. And it's a quote by a speech by Fritz Stern, in which the German historian, now I'm quoting your book, in which the German historian drew distinct parallels between contemporary America and 1930s Germany. Stern's message was that the rise of National Socialism was neither inevitable nor a function of the mesmerizing power of a single charismatic individual. This is a speech from 2004.
Right.
Too often overlooked, he noted, was the role of conservative intellectuals financed by corporate interests who denounced liberalism as the greatest, most invidious threat and attacked it for its tolerance, rationality, and cosmopolitan culture. Furthermore, many, many Protestant clergy share these conservative elites' rabid nationalism, their disdain for the Weimar period's loose morals, and their hostility to the liberal secular state.
Yeah, it's a remarkable quote, and I'm glad you pointed out it was from 2004. So this is not a comment on, you know, Trump or Obama. This is a comment on America during the Bush years and immediately after the invasion of Iraq and so forth. And I think it was really prescient, and it's eerie to hear it now. So you could say, based on that quote, that the conditions for the sort of unfortunate alliances we see now among American Christians, you know, were created long before now.
What were some of the most defining characteristics that American historians and theologians highlighted about Bonhoeffer shortly after his passing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because Bonhoeffer really wasn't known at all in America in the 1950s. His reputation was even not that great in Germany, because he lived to be only 39. He had not published a lot of the things he had written during his life had not been published, and he had not really had an active teaching job or an active sort of public pastorate for most of his life. But the letters and papers that he wrote in prison had been preserved by his friend Eberhard Bethge, who published them in the 50s. And then that book, Letters and Papers from Prison, was published in English in the 60s. And slowly, Bonhoeffer's story came to be known in the States. But it's really, I think, probably not until the 1980s that Bonhoeffer becomes really well known. Maybe the mid 70s. I remember reading The Cost of Discipleship when I was in college, and although I didn't know anything about Bonhoeffer, at least his books, you know, were available in English, and they were used. In my case, I was part of a Christian parachurch training group where we were required to read that. So I'm guessing the 70s were probably the point where it was possible to read Bonhoeffer in English and try to get a sense of the arc of his life. But as I point out in some of the stuff I've written, the ways Bonhoeffer has been interpreted, you know, have really shifted over time, and actually they've coalesced into these sort of portraits where you have a sort of liberal Bonhoeffer, a conservative or evangelical Bonhoeffer, and then you get a sort of secular, non-sectarian Bonhoeffer. And I think it speaks to how impressive his story is and how dramatic his life was. Everybody wants to claim him. And as I was working on this book, you know, I was aware already of these various portraits. I was really interested in trying to understand how Bonhoeffer had come to be used as in support of Donald Trump. That to me was sort of the end point I was trying to understand. And so I went back to 9/11 and started to look at Bonhoeffer's reception in America following 9/11 and through the Bush presidencies and Obama and so forth. And what I found was that at least since 9/11, Bonhoeffer has been one of those figures that sort of people are drawn to explain whatever's happening around them. especially if it's something that's viewed as you know, a crisis or something, you know, that needs to be explained because it has big implications for our country. And so the Iraq War is a good example where people came out on both sides, you know, both claiming Bonhoeffer, on both sides claiming Bonhoeffer for their positions. And then during the Obama era, there was a lot of resistance to some policies associated with that era in which people, you know, cited Obama. And then we get to the 2016 election, and we have the example of Eric Metaxas, who had written an influential biography of Bonhoeffer in 2010, who then becomes a big supporter of Trump and advocate for Trump's presidency in ways that, if you know anything about Bonhoeffer and about his life, seem really impossible. But I think what happened is that Bonhoeffer had become a cipher for so many different views of things and so many different agendas that by that time it didn't even really seem all that outlandish that Eric Metaxas would, as somebody who knew something about Bonhoeffer, would become this devotee of Trump.
So what does Metaxas get wrong about Bonhoeffer?
Well, it's a really good question.
Hold on. After reading your book, yeah. I have to ask, have you ever met him?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
And the other question people generally ask is, have you heard from him? And the answer to that is no as well. I think he lives in a bubble of sorts that's pretty protected from what scholars think. And so I'm not that surprised. I do hope at some point that we will have some communication. But at any rate, what did he get wrong? Well, you know, the book itself is relatively accurate. There are a couple of places where he makes some glaring errors, and I think they're errors that fit his agenda. One of them is where he talks about Hitler being democratically elected, which is an error that's easily corrected. But I think part of his point is to suggest, this is written during the Obama era, that in fact, you know, fascist dictators can be democratically elected. The other error that is sort of glaring from the book has to do with the Barman Declaration and this document of the Confessing Church that he says condemned anti-Semitism, which it clearly doesn't mention anti-Semitism or Jews. But again, I think it's part of his attempt to portray the Confessing Church and Bonhoeffer as advocates for Jews and opponents against Hitler based on what they saw in Jewish suffering, which is a complicated issue. But the real problem with Metaxas' take on Bonhoeffer came after the book was published, and he went on this sort of speaking tour and interview tour, mainly to Fox News shows, Glenn Beck and so forth, where he would talk about Bonhoeffer in ways that were designed to appeal to the listeners and really make these parallels between what was going on in Germany in the 30s and what was happening then, like 2010, 2011, and so forth, in America. In other words, portraying the Obama era as an era of creeping totalitarianism and claiming that Bonhoeffer was the one who really would be our guide in this fraught period.
So there's a famous misquote of Bonhoeffer. There's actually a few, but one that yeah. I think Metaxas probably amplifies and many other on the right amplify is, not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act. So where exactly does that quote come from? Did that quote come from? And how did it wind up being attributed to Bonhoeffer?
Some really good questions. There's a guy, a blogger named Warren Throckmorton, who has dived deeply into this question, and he's written a couple of blog posts on it, and I think they're cited in my book. And he finds a couple of sources for this quote. One of them is a museum in Philadelphia, I think called the Liberty Museum, that had an exhibition at one point in the 90s that cited this quote in credited to Bonhoeffer. The other source is a book from the 70s. I can't remember the author, but someone that I'd never heard of. And so how did it get to be attributed to Bonhoeffer? Well, I think the real answer to that question is that it is on the inner back flap of Metaxas's book attributed to Bonhoeffer. And from there, it's migrated to a lot of other places, including, you know, posters and, you know, people's websites and Facebook pages and T-shirts. And it sort of has taken on a momentum of its own. I will say that it kind of sounds like Bonhoeffer, and it's not, I don't think it's something that Bonhoeffer would have disagreed with necessarily, but it suggests the carelessness with which Metaxas and some others have treated Bonhoeffer's legacy, that they don't seem to care that it's now been demonstrated conclusively that this is not something Bonhoeffer ever said.
Yeah, it's interesting. In your book, you talk about populist, you know, all these different Bonhoeffers, right? And there's populist Bonhoeffer. And populism implies a suspicion of academic elites. So it's not surprising that shapers of this image of populist Bonhoeffer don't lean on credentialed scholars, and therefore the facts they present are often erroneous or skewed.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And, you know, this populist moment we live in does carry with it this sort of suspicion of people who are credentialed or otherwise elite. And Metaxas really represents this, because even though many Bonhoeffer scholars have reviewed his book and pointed out errors of interpretation and errors of fact, he has never really acknowledged that. And he's just constantly doubled down to defend everything that he has said, which is a really strange way for someone who purports to be a scholar to act. I mean, the scholarly dialogue is about, you know, putting your stuff out there and getting feedback and criticism and corrections and sort of, you know, moving the argument forward. The argument that the statement Metaxas makes, the claim he makes, that I think is the most erroneous, the most misleading, going back to your earlier question, is that Bonhoeffer's legacy was hijacked in the 1960s by a group of people called the Death of God theologians. And by the way, that part is true, that there was a group of theologians in the 1960s who misread Bonhoeffer and wanted to use him for their own purposes. The problem is Metaxas basically equates those interpreters with all Bonhoeffer scholars. In other words, people who interpret, people like me, people like Victoria Barnett, Clifford Green, who are Bonhoeffer scholars active today, he sees them as just another incarnation of these 1960s folks who have an agenda, a liberal, agnostic, these are all terms that basically mean the same thing to Metaxas, agenda that sort of distorts Bonhoeffer's legacy and can't be trusted. And so basically everybody but him has gotten it wrong. And I think that's the real misleading thing, that people who like the book and think it tells a good story and, you know, is very compelling, often think they have to agree with Metaxas that anything else that's been written by Bonhoeffer is tainted by some liberal bias.
For our listeners, who were these Death of God people, just briefly?
Yeah, it's a group of theologians in the early 60s who recognized that, you know, we were in kind of a different era, what they called a secular era, an era in which, you know, the word God and sort of traditional Christian concepts were less credible to the common person than they had been in the past. And so they were looking for a way to sort of update Christianity's relevance. And they saw in people like Bonhoeffer, somebody who had seen ahead of time, as it were, you know, what was coming. And so Bonhoeffer has these quotations, these things he writes in letters and papers from prison, where he talks about religionless Christianity, and he mentions a world come of age. And Bonhoeffer seems to recognize that after the devastation of World War II and the co-opting of Christianity, that the church will have to go about its business differently, and that it will be religion will be more difficult to take seriously. And so they really seize on a few quotations from Bonhoeffer and try to make it the basis of their own theology. And what Bethke, who was the recipient of these letters that they referred to, pointed out, is that, you know, they had sort of missed the larger context of Bonhoeffer's theology and the continuities between his later stuff and earlier stuff. And Bonhoeffer scholars generally today agree that this was a misstep, a misinterpretation, a sort of temporary fad. So nobody but Metaxas seems to think that, you know, the death of God theologians are taken seriously by Bonhoeffer scholars. But for him, who doesn't know much about the field of Bonhoeffer scholarship, he sees this as the sort of paradigm of what Bonhoeffer scholarship is.
So sticking with conservatives for another moment and then moving on to maybe more liberal interpretations of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, can we discuss, you talk about all these Bonhoeffer moments. One of them is Kim Davis's Bonhoeffer moment in the wake of the Obergefell v. Hodges Supreme Court decision, which essentially legalized same-sex marriage.
Right.
And this created for conservatives a moment of lifting up Bonhoeffer as someone who would stand up against same-sex marriage.
Right. Yeah, it's a fascinating sort of time in the history of Bonhoeffer reception. The term Bonhoeffer moment had been used a couple times previous to 2015. The most recent one prior to that had been Metaxas himself in a address he gave at the National Prayer Breakfast in 2012. But this term Bonhoeffer moment became a real rallying cry for conservative forces in the run-up to the Obergefell decision, which they suspected was going to go in the direction it did. And it's interesting that, and I talk about this in the book, they don't define the term Bonhoeffer moment. They never really say what it means. But I think Metaxas is largely responsible for that. I think Metaxas had so sort of saturated evangelical Christianity with this idea of Bonhoeffer as a conservative culture warrior, as somebody who would have stood up to the things that were happening in America in the 21st century, that it was, I think it became the case that when you said Bonhoeffer moment, everybody knew that you meant the sort of resistance to liberal-leaning trends in American culture. As you mentioned, though, it came and went pretty quickly, because once the Supreme Court decided in the way it did, there wasn't a lot of follow through, and I don't know what the follow through might have been. I mean, were they going to try to assassinate the president or blow up the Supreme Court? I mean, these were the sorts of things that commentators asked in the wake of the 2015 Bonhoeffer moment, because those are the sorts of things that Bonhoeffer ultimately, you know, felt like he was forced to do.
Reggie Williams has claimed that Bonhoeffer's time in Harlem, you talked earlier about all the traveling Bonhoeffer did between World War One and World War II. Reggie Williams has claimed that it was Bonhoeffer when he spent time at Union Theological Seminary, and he spent time in Harlem and in black churches. And he argues that this time is critical to understanding Bonhoeffer's whole project, and especially some of his shifts toward empathy and resistance. Do you see similar importance in Bonhoeffer's life? Do you see an affinity for Bonhoeffer and black theology and church witness?
Yeah, I think Reggie's right. I think this was a really important year for Bonhoeffer in New York, 1930-31, in a lot of ways, partly because of his experiences in Harlem, which were, of course, different from anything he'd ever seen or experienced before. I think partly because of his interaction with Jean Lacerre, another student at Union who was there as a sort of exchange student with Bonhoeffer, and who was a pacifist, and who introduced Bonhoeffer to the concept of Christian pacifism. I think just seeing Germany and German culture from the outside, you know, this is one of the times he was able to do that. And the argument's been made that Bonhoeffer really used his awareness of the way African Americans were viewed by the larger society in America as a way for refocusing his perception of Jews in Germany. I think there's some truth to that as well.
So what about Charles Marsh's Bonhoeffer? What did he get wrong about Bonhoeffer?
You know, I don't know that Charles gets a lot wrong. The thing in his biography, A Strange Glory, that I think has left most Bonhoeffer scholars unconvinced is his claim that Bonhoeffer and Bake had a homoerotic relationship. Now, if I remember correctly, Marsh doesn't claim that it was consummated, but that it was, at least on Bonifer's side, it was very much, you know, had the markings of a love relationship, of a more erotic relationship than just a friendship. And there's been resistance to that. I don't know that it would be possible to prove one way or another, you know, that claim. But I would say generally that that's not been an argument that's been accepted by the mainstream of Bonhoeffer scholarship. So I guess the mainstream sort of exists in between Metaxas on the one side and then some of the more controversial claims that have been made by other scholars on the other side.
So you end your book with a plea to the church in America and to evangelicals to have their own Bonhoeffer moment. Would you feel okay maybe discussing that with us?
Yeah, the letter at the end, called An Open Letter to Christians Who Love Bonhoeffer and Still Support Trump, really began in my mind as a letter to my parents. And like a lot of families, we found ourselves in the place where, you know, we had all for a long time disagreed on political matters, but we couldn't even discuss things after 2016. And so even writing this letter to my parents, sharing those things with them, didn't really seem possible. So I wrote it to a more general audience, but I was thinking of my parents and other people I knew. And the letter talks about my own background in evangelical Christianity and growing up in a church in Key Biscayne, Florida, that was closely connected with Richard Nixon, and the way our pastor in particular had gotten very close to Nixon and then was very upset and felt betrayed when sort of the reality of Watergate rolled out. So the letter that I include at the end of the book is really an attempt to get evangelical Christians who support Trump to think about the long-term impact of what they, of their support for Trump. And, you know, it's clear that they believe, you know, they're willing to put up with a certain amount of things that they maybe, they find morally objectionable in order to get these larger, get supported on these larger culture issues like, abortion. But I really try to emphasize the dangers in this approach and sort of devaluation of the Christian brand, as it were. I try to be very personal in that letter and very direct to the people I'm thinking about as I'm writing.
The book is The Battle for Bonhoeffer, Stephen Haynes, Debating Discipleship in the Age of Trump. Thank you so much for your time.
Joined by Pastor Jose Humphreys, who is a pastor in East Harlem and wrote a book recently that was really inspiring to me as a local pastor and church planner in Durham, North Carolina. His book is called Seeing Jesus in East Harlem, What Happens When Churches... help me with the subtitle.
Oh, what happens when churches show up and stay put.
When churches show up and stay put. That's good. Harlem in particular was really important to Diedrich Bonhoeffer. And in Reggie Williams' book, he pulls a quote from one of Diedrich Bonhoeffer's letters that says that Diedrich Bonhoeffer says, "I became a Christian in Harlem." And your experience on the ground as a pastor, what is it about your place that makes it so special and your experience in that place?
Well, Harlem, it's just a beautiful neighborhood, and it's its own world in many ways. It has a deep, rich history that's rooted in Harlem Renaissance. Bonhoeffer was able to study not only with Niebuhr, but in his sights from whom he could see the Jackson housing projects, and he was in touch with a particular experience to him that was distinctive from Germany. So he walks into Renaissance and struggle, and there's this interplay of different forces There's the intellectual capital of Black Harlem and Harlem Renaissance, right, with poets like Langston Hughes and Howard University President Elaine Locke, who he also happened to meet in Washington, D.C. And he meets Adam Clayton Powell, of course, who was the pastor of the historic Abyssinian Church. And he begins to have conversations with these people, these luminaries, and they begin to shape his theology in a way that takes this abstracted form of white Jesus, which is what the German state church was propagating, and bring Jesus back into a context that really connected him to a more scriptural and faithful biblical Jesus.
Yeah, that's good. I'm interested in this picture of you know, this mid-30s German scholar at that point. He's got, you know, multiple PhDs under his belt, and he goes to Union, and he's acquainted with Harlem. And I'd just be curious, some of your reflection on ways that you've maybe experienced people like that, that have come to your place, have come to Harlem, and have shown a posture like Bonhoeffer towards learning and having their minds and hearts change, and maybe some less healthy ways that people come to Harlem or some of the mm-hmm. adjacent neighborhoods, that some of the forces of renewal, urban renewal and gentrification, things happen. Just kind of your reflection on good and bad ways to enter a place and as you've said, to stay put.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting that Bonhoeffer gets to Union, and one of his first commentaries I remember is, there's no, you know, real theology happening here. And it was this real critique of, you know, what is basically known as a liberal Baptist. Right. But juxtaposed to that was his experience as a Sunday school teacher at Abyssinian Church, which I didn't know about, and his conversations and connections with the African-American experience, which he described as being, if I'm not mistaken, kind of, or finding a melancholy kind of hope, you know, an exuberance in the midst of crisis, right? Deep crisis. And he's painting these parallel pictures between how people are being treated here in the United States of America, specifically by white people, and yet seeing how African Americans are just coming at it from a different grounding and location, and from the same scriptures as those same scriptures that were being used in direct opposition in Germany, and how that was being used to exterminate and arrest and just detain people who didn't meet a certain profile of whiteness. So for me, I think the personal connections are, somebody like Bonhoeffer comes in. Well, that would be awesome, right? If, you know, somebody like Bonhoeffer comes into your neighborhood. But if you think about it, you know, the profile of educated white person who may even have some sort of theological foundation, you realize how you show up, which is a theme in my book. How you show up can actually impact and even ground your theology in a lot more dimensional ways. And that's what happened to Bonhoeffer. It was transformative. Like, theology was no longer an abstraction. Jesus was no longer abstracted, disconnected from his brown Jewish Palestinian roots, but he was seeing Jesus through the suffering of people, and how this suffering Christ comes into fellowship with those who are on the margins. Specifically, his ecclesiology is deep. He wrote things like, I remember, the church being the empathic community of Christ, right? The empathic extension of Christ. And empathy was huge. If you think about what was happening in Germany and how governments and churches were in collusion, and there was a lack of not only compassion, but there was an extreme dehumanization of society and how religion was going about in its cahoots with the state. He comes to the United States and he sees a totally different picture and finds Christ in suffering. And when I have conversations with white folks coming into black and brown spaces, that's one of our first conversations, just like, how does place influence our theology? How are we seeing the image of God in peoples and histories and in culture? And how does that reflect the image of Christ? And in many ways, these conversations serve to just really ground people's theology in a social ethic, a deep social ethic.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and I think it's fascinating. I think one of the great successes of your book that I really loved, I think it really comes at the intersection of some of these, you might call them fads or popularities or trends of multi-ethnic church, but also kind of a parish model kind of located church. And I think it's fascinating because either one of those constructs or ideas can actually serve to further entrench some of these deep wounds and kind of empower some of these powers and principalities that are working amongst us. And I do see Bonhoeffer as a way to short circuit some of those things. But I think your book did a great job of kind of working at that intersection.
And so I find people's experiences of entering into black and brown spaces mindfully, with conversation and with intention, it can lead to a real transformative journey, as it did with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, if people are open to it, right?
Yeah, and the other quotation from him that I paraphrase, I don't have it in front of me, but it's been really popularized, is you know, basically essentially the way to destroy a community is to come to try to create community with your own idea of how it should be. And I really see that reflected in the wisdom that you're sharing with your readers and counseling others to come in with a posture of humility and learning and to reckon with some of these conversations and forces in our midst right away.
Thank you so much. You know, there's one more thing. You know, when he had great hopes for the church, even in the midst of how he saw this deep collusion between church and state in Germany. And he wrote things like, the church is not the church unless it exists for others. And you could see how that quote could be inspired about what he saw in Germany, and as he juxtaposed in Harlem in the 30s, right? And there was just this, I think, a reimagination that he experienced that allowed him to return to Germany with a greater faith and a renewed perspective of not only social ethics, but what the gospel of Jesus Christ is as well.
I wanted to tell you to have a good, clear cantus firmus. That is the only way to a full and perfect sound, when the counterpoint has a firm support and can't come adrift or get out of tune while remaining a distinct whole in its own right. Only a polyphony of this kind can give life a wholeness and at the same time assure us that nothing calamitous can happen as long as the cantus firmus is kept going. In a fractured and polarized society, how do we hold it all together? While this question is really deeply prescient today, this was essentially the same question that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was writing about in May 1944 from a Flossenbürg prison to his former student and friend Eberhard Bethge. You might expect a 38-year-old pastor and scholar to write in a really intricate theological or philosophical or even technocratic mode. Instead, though, T. Diedrich wrote in musical terms. He used words like cantus firmus and counterpoint in polyphony, and I'm not a musical theorist. You have to talk to Bob about that stuff, but it seems important to Dietrich Bonhoeffer's whole project that he speak this way. For Bonhoeffer, who was playing Mozart sonatas on the piano at the age of 10, speaking musically was kind of a natural way to talk, maybe even prior to speaking theologically. And even especially in prison, speaking musically provided key insights and access into the ways that he thought about life and God. I think of the scene in Shawshank Redemption where Tim Robbins' character, Andy Dufresne, basks in the fleeting presence of a record player's hopeful duet from The Marriage of Figaro amidst the hopelessness and isolation and monotony of life in a prison camp. I remember Morgan Freeman's great voice says, those two Italian ladies were saying something too beautiful that can't be expressed in words that makes your heart ache because of it. Bonhoeffer seemed to have this same sort of vibrant inner musical life, even despite the compulsory silence around him. He wrote in a letter, "The music we hear inwardly can almost surpass, if we really concentrate on it, what we hear physically." His words to Bethke bear concern and instruction that the love of God might be the steady backbeat in which all other loves and experiences, even pain, even joy, and both at the same time can make sense. A polyphony, all these different sounds can exist, and they can even contribute to flourishing into fullness, as long as the cantus firmus is kept going. Theologians like Jeremy Begbie, who we've done an episode with, have commented on this, and John DeGrunchy accounts also for the ways that music and the arts provide a medium for Dietrich Bonhoeffer to think theologically. In Jeremy's words, this is theology through the arts. And Bonhoeffer scholar Reggie Williams, who wrote Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus, really takes pains to consider just how impactful the black gospel music of Abyssinian Baptist Church was on Bonhoeffer's thought and the trajectory of his faith-based activism and resistance against both Hitler, but also the acquiescing state church. Man, I'd love to sort through that bin of LPs. By and large, most scholars don't pay much attention to these musical instincts for Bonhoeffer. Considering this lesser explored side, I was reminded of a really beautiful recording of one of his prayers in Letters and Papers from Prison. It's included on the 2013 Bifrost Arts release, one of those records that I'm sure I sent an email to Bob to check out. It's called He Will Not Cry Out. And this Charlottesville Congregational Music Collective released a translation and recording of an old Taizé song called Aber du weißt. It's a translation of the final line of the song from Taizé. Bifrost's English translation is simply titled Bonhoeffer's Prayer. This text shows some of those theo-musical instincts. It's a morning prayer to reestablish the cantus firmus in the midst of the polyphony. Bonhoeffer prays, "I'm feeble in heart, but with you there's help. I'm restless, but with you there's peace. In me there's bitterness, but with you there's patience. I don't understand your ways, but you know the way for me." It's also significant that this prayer was picked up by the Taizé community for their worship chants. Taizé, if you're not familiar with it, is an ecumenical Christian community located in central France. It was founded by Brother Roger in 1940 for refugees of war, and needless to say, Brother Roger and his friends also had run-ins in the early 40s with the Gestapo. Still to this day, the brothers of the Taizé community cultivate a robust and hospitable space of worship and peacemaking for refugees and spiritual pilgrims. They sing songs They're really more like chants, and they're invitational, and they're musically inclusive, but they're also deeply formative in and across differences. Their tunes are simple and repetitive, but they're also really spacious, and they're broad and spacious enough for a multilingual polyphony. But they're also solid and steady enough to bring many different voices into a distinct whole. By chanting with other worshipers in the style of Tze, there's an actual performance of the prayer. You become what you are hoping for. You pray for unity and peace, and you start to then participate in unity and peace. I got the opportunity to correspond with Isaac Wardell, the leader of the Bifrost Arts Project and now the Porter's Gate Worship Project. He mentioned how his community in Charlottesville at Trinity Church talks a lot about Bonhoeffer and has used his book Life Together as kind of a source text to structure their own community practices. It seemed like a no-brainer to attempt to use his words in their local congregational worship. And Isaac mentioned that when they started to make this their own, they recorded an original demo with singers Molly Pardon and Tomber Chirpke, and it was intended to be really meditative and quiet and intimate and minimalistic. Record really started to progress with more and more energy and more percussion, and throughout there's that steady rhythm section. Bonhoeffer addresses common worship life in his little book, Life Together, and discusses unison and harmony and polyphony in his writings, not just as a theory, but as a way of being together. For church musicians like Isaac Wardell and for singing communities that are really different, as geographically and culturally diverse as Trinity Presbyterian in Charlottesville or Tze community in France, Bonhoeffer gives this multi-dimensional but also really contemporary paradigm for how to hold these things together. Church things like prayer and preaching and worship with worldly things like peacemaking and fighting for justice. He sets an example for how to develop and tend a robust cantus firmus in the midst of polyphony. Wardell says that Bonhoeffer's theological influence is able to present congregational worship, real people in real places singing in congregations, as both a prophetic act of courage, but also a priestly act of humility. Here's Bonhoeffer's Prayer by Bifrost Arts. Enjoy. Thank you.
Wow, Chris, that was a great first episode together, and I think people have a lot to think about now when they're thinking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and hopefully for some of our listeners who never heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, they'll be encouraged to look at some resources that you're putting together and we're going to put on the website.
Yeah, I'm going to put up a little annotated bibliography with some resources, some links that you can get a little deeper in, and some brief descriptions to kind of help you know where to start.
Well, we will look for that, and you and I are looking forward to the next episode coming soon already. And once again, welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, RTN Theology is produced by Bob Crawford and Chris Breslin, edited by Bob Crawford.
Today we featured music from Bifrost Arts, featuring Molly Pardon and Tambur Chirpke.
I'm really excited because people have been writing in to ask who sings the song that we've been playing at the end of the past few RTN Theologies. It's David Childers, and the song is called Jesus Said, and it is not on any record that I'm aware of, and we actually, David and I, recorded it on my front porch at my house. So, ladies and gentlemen, David Childers.
He will save the best for last when salvation comes to pass. Come to me, Jesus said. Jesus.